Yes, I am also with the speakerphone. You hear me okay?
Yes, yes, perfect. Thank you. So, do you need some briefing more about the report and the context?
I don't think so. I have your emails.
Okay. Also, as I told you in the introduction, it's a report for the European Commission, DG Education and Culture, and I'm going to make them understand the potential of open education and open educational research by grasping a little more in depth in the business and sustainability models of initiatives. It's going to be quite short. I try to release the report in October because it's the first building block of a 3-year project. So this is more or less the situation.
Okay.
I don't know if you have time to go through the guideline I sent you. Of course, it's very long, so we don't have to go through all the questions. It's just that maybe you've got some interesting inputs in subjects that, are not... So if you want, we can begin.
Yeah, I did review the questions in advance.
Okay, perfect. So I will be typing your answers more or less at the same time, so maybe sometimes there's a little bit of loneliness, but it's going to be okay.
All right.
So in your opinion, I see by the literature review and by my interviews with experts that people have very scattered understanding of the field and they don't know other such movements like the free software movement or the free culture movement or even the access to knowledge movement. It looks like everything is disconnected, so I'm trying to make a genealogy so everything is a little bit more linked. And I would like to know, in your opinion, which are the main influences or reasons that explain the emergence of the open education movement?
Yeah, there are diverse influences. I think you're correct about that. There is the influence of the open source software movement, which, of course, was pioneered by people like Richard Stallman. And that has had a pervasive influence over open educational content in general. And many of the initiatives are styled after Stallman's Four Freedoms.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Creative Commons movement, excuse me, which addresses open content in general and does so by means of creating a set of licenses people can use to make their content more accessible rather than the default copyright protected license.
Mm-hmm.
There is the Open Archives Initiative, and that's kind of a root movement that has sprouted a number of things. There are basically the idea of Open Archives Initiative is that it created a set of specifications for hosting open archives, that is to say, large collections of documents. It also released sample software to allow people to create these archives themselves. It has spawned initiatives such as OIST-E-R, O-A-I-S-T-E-R, which is a directory of open archive initiatives. There's also Open Door, Open D-O-A-R is another one. It also had, as a direct successor, MIT's DSpace initiative, which again is another set of specifications and software, mostly software for open archives.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some academic movements, for example, the Budapest Open Archive Initiative and various other declarations in education. There's a thing called the Cape Town Declaration, and there's a series of those declaring support for open content and open access. There's the UNESCO Open Educational Resources Initiative. That's a series of conferences, initiatives, proposals, standardizations, and definitions surrounding a general movement toward encouraging countries to adopt open educational resources. Various funding councils have announced open access mandates. For example, the National Institute for Health, NIH, has an open access mandate. These are supported by open access journals. For example, PubMed Central, and a variety of others. There's the work that's been done by David Wiley. He has an annual open content conference. He proposed an open content license before Creative Commons. He's one of the major players in an open publisher called Flat World Publishing, which is pretty much a model for open access publishing initiatives.
Excuse me, but I would like to know, do you have a contact with somebody of Flat World Knowledge? Because I'm trying to reach them, and I send quite a lot of emails, so I don't know if you know somebody from there.
Well, David Wiley is one person, and let me just check. Here we go. Yes, I think. Okay, I have a contact whose firm represents a number of small publishers in Canada, including Flat World. So he's a representative of Flat World, not directly Flat World. Jim Rosa. And
Okay, but you hear me? Hello?
yes, I hear you.
Okay, because a part of the experts interviews I'm making also an online survey to initiatives. So maybe I could give it to you and you could forward it to this person because maybe he's interested to fill it up regarding his open publishing initiative. So maybe I don't reach Flat World Knowledge, but maybe I reach another initiative that is similar and it's okay with me. But
Sure.
bueno, I'm just laughing. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. What I'm doing is I'm copying the email, or I'm going to forward the email I got from Jim Rocha to you, and that will give you the information you need.
Thank you very much.
Oh, no
Understand.
problem. So,
And I
yeah.
wanted to ask you all this about those key events and persons and space that allow the emergence of the movement. Why do you think it's also very related to the current, well, the past 2 decades debates regarding intellectual property frameworks in the digital age? I mean, everything has changed with
Yeah.
technology, so. But this is something that I don't see popping up so often in literature review, maybe more in your production.
Now, you're talking probably about the for example, the renegotiations over a copyright at the WIPO, World International, oh, I forget what it's called, World Intellectual Property Organization, and things like that.
WIPO Act. But also
Yeah.
everything that are going with the organization Trade Commerce, all the things that have been happening the last 20 years that have been also very important for the counter-globalization movement in the 90s.
Yeah. I would be very hesitant to say that the open access movement is a response to these. I would say it's a parallel development. They each represent two major sides in a much wider debate, and they've each tried to enact measures or promote measures that promote their own perspective or point of view. And when Stallman founded GPL, he wasn't responding to WIPO or anything like that, or WTO or anything like that. I don't think he'd even heard of them. What he was responding to were specific licenses that he was encountering in working with Unix. I think that's pretty common. I've written about some of the non-GPL open access, open software movements, and these developed as a result of practice in the field where commercial software vendors would find open source content, they would copy it, make a small change, and call it their own. Right? So the licenses that were developed in response to specific practices. So it's not that these two movements are reacting to each other. They're both reacting to behaviors in the field, concrete behaviors in the field.
In this case, in the case of open of education and learning, it will be reactions to which kind of behaviors in the field?
Well, textbook prices and journal prices. These are the specific things that motivate a lot of, especially the institutional approach to open access. In Canada, for example, we have a thing called access copyright. And access copyright is a collective of publishers that has formed a license pool whereby educational institutions pay them a royalty for photocopying that happens on their campuses. And access copyright has recently come out with a major new deal that, you know, multiplies, I forget the exact, but it goes up from something like $10 per student to $45 per student at a time when there's less photocopying than ever. So it's in response to that sort of action that universities in Canada, first of all, are refusing to sign the agreement, but secondly, are looking more seriously at open access textbooks and open access content to replace the content previously used that they had to pay for. And that's typical. There was a development when the Kindle Reader, I think it was Kindle, first came out. Licensing provisions on documents included, you cannot read this document aloud. And it raises issues, you know, particularly when the license that says you cannot read this document aloud is attached to a book that has been in the public domain for generations. For example, a classic novel or something like that. And that's the sort of thing, again, we see, you know, on the side of open content and open source advocates, we see these sorts of behaviors and attempts to craft systems, mechanisms, and lobbying in response to them.
Okay, and why do you think, I saw that the increase of publishing industry in academy in 10 years transformed to a main oligopoly, and that they got a market profit that is higher than any kind of other industry? How do you think that we get to this situation?
Well, it's a monopoly market.
It's the markets that are so oligopoly and they don't get these marks of benefits.
There's where else can educational institutions turn for published content? You know, I mean, they have to go through the educational publishers, which is a very small market. And, you know, I mean, prices in any market are always determined by customers' willingness to pay. And publishers discovered they can keep raising the prices and institutions will keep paying them. So they raise them. And institutions keep paying them because they have an entire system of promotion and tenure based around these publications.
And what do you think are now currently the main bottlenecks that are preventing to have a mainstreaming of using open textbooks or open academic publications, apart of the lobbying of the publishers?
There is the lobbying of the publishers, but besides that, I would say one of the major functions that publishers provide that hasn't been well replicated in open access is the selection and vetting of content for accuracy. Publishers, when a book is published or a journal article is published or an educational resource is published by a commercial publisher, we have some assurance that this resource is correct, that it has been properly reviewed, that people can rely on it as accurate. And there are not similarly strong mechanisms in the world of open access. And there are reasons for that. The main reason is cost. The mechanism for verifying accuracy creates a lot of overhead, creates a lot of cost in addition to the cost of printing and distributing a resource. And there isn't yet a good mechanism in the OER community to do this without involving the same sorts of costs. There are some mechanisms that have been proposed. For example, people like Stephen Harned and Peter Suber talk about open source publishing, the green and the gold models, which preserve the structure of existing journals, but create mechanisms so that the contents of these journals are available as open access. And these models would include personal archiving and institutional archiving. There are also sustainability models built in, for example, upfront author fees or publication fees that would pay for the cost of publishing and distributing. There are other mechanisms. For example, the Open Journal Systems software that was developed in Simon Fraser University in Canada, which automates a lot of these processes so that a journal author or a journal editor can manage volunteer labor, volunteer academics, in the usual process of reviewing and vetting without involving all of that overhead that is typically involved by publishers.
Mm-hmm.
But this is hard. This leads, though, to a secondary issue, and because these mechanisms work well for academic journals, but they don't work well for things that are non-academic, things like popular books, textbooks, exercises, online courses, things like that. Journal articles are tied to the system of academic tenure and promotion. Professors are paid for producing journal articles, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But textbooks and workbooks and online courses are not tied to promotion and tenure in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So they represent extra work that an academic would do. Typically, they would receive royalties from publishers for doing this sort of work. Not very large royalties, but something. But in the world of open access, this incentive is taken away. So there needs to be more of a formal recognition and support for the production of these non-academic resources. And, there are initiatives in place. And, I think of things like the Media Awareness Network in Canada, which was a government-funded organization that produced a whole range of learning resources. And there are various other organizations worldwide. There are things like Wiki Educator and Kiriki and Wikiversity. These are three separate initiatives that are forming collectives to author academic material. So there are initiatives,
okay, sorry.
But
collectives too?
Pardon?
You say that Wikiversity and Wiki Educator were forming collectives too?
Yeah, they are collectives. I would say they are collectives. They are a group of people working toward the same objective in a common space, where that space is a wiki.
And which is the objective, sorry?
I'm sorry?
The objective is to give recognition and awareness about the open educational resources that are created, you mean?
Well, and not just that, but yes, but also to actually produce open educational resources.
Okay. I get it. And then, in the other side of the coin, what would be, according to you, the main motivations to engage in the production of OER? And maybe those motivations have evolved in 10 years, so I would like to have your opinion about current.
Yeah. I've seen surveys, and they've been relatively consistent over time. Academics, especially, are motivated by non-commercial considerations. This is largely because academic employment pays reasonably well. But this is also because academics strive to achieve recognition in their field of study. And it's this recognition, I think, that is one of the major motivators for the creation of open access resources and open educational resources. There have been various surveys, and there are some articles, for example, in the journal IRRODL, describing the difference between citation rates for open access and closed access journals.
Yeah.
And the citation rates for open access journals are consistently higher, and there are different reasons for this. But if a person wants to increase their citations, which is a major motivation for academics, then they have an incentive to publish as an open access resource. Go ahead.
No, my idea is that if we go to, in the future, that everything gets more open, this recognition is going to be dissolved because it will become the norm, the open publication and the open access.
Yeah.
Which new rewards or motivations are going to pop up?
Well, it's not that the recognition disappears. You still got recognition. What is dissolved is the advantage that you have over people who are publishing in closed access journals. And yeah, that advantage disappears. And I've actually noticed that effect. And it's the effect that occurs anytime any domain becomes popular. The early advantage is a little bit lost. But, there's advantages now for early movers that remain in place even after everybody moves into open access. If you look at, for example, network theory as described by people like Alfred Laszlo Barabasi, the first people into the domain are the people who other people tend to cite even after everybody has moved into the domain because they have a first mover advantage.
It's the Matthew effect.
Pardon?
It's called in social network theory the Matthew effect.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's
a good point.
But the question is also, okay, so all the journals are open access. Why then would someone publish? I think there's a really good argument here because if they don't, nobody will know what they do. So that major incentive still exists. Additionally, a lot of grants are tied to publication. From research institutes, government-sponsored research agencies, etc. For example, in Canada, we have Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council grants and National Science and Engineering Research Council grants, among others. And to receive one of these research grants from the government, you need to disseminate your results in the form of publication. And as I mentioned earlier, more and more of these council grants are requiring that publication be open access publication. So the incentive is tied to the grant. To get the research grant, you are expected to publish, and you are expected to publish openly. So in order to continue receiving these grants, academics and other producers of academic content will publish openly.
Bueno, this is a strong consensus among all the people I'm interviewing. Public money, bueno, research funded with public money should be released with openly, and I find this very logic, a little bit late for me, but it's good.
Yeah, it's taken a long time because, you know, for a long time there have been commercial interests that have profited significantly from these public expenditures in research, and they have obviously resisted the loss of their unique access. But what's happening is they are changing their business models as well, because they have to.
And I would like to know, we have been talking quite a lot of higher education, but do you think that things are really different in the school system? I'm talking primary and secondary school, the stuff before going to the university.
Yeah.
I understand, for instance, here, and I guess it's the same stuff in Canada, it's really more rigid because of the curricular definition that generally is like developed at the government level,
yeah,
national level. So the issue of open textbooks can be complicated and this kind of thing. So I don't know what is going to be and if it's more difficult to get the open educational resource deployed in the primary and secondary school.
It's more difficult because it's a much larger market.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the people defending that market are much more entrenched. And there are high barriers to entry, as you point out, the very specific curricular requirements. Typically, as with many sources or many types of government contracting, in order to be entered into the market at all, you have to be able to put yourself into a position of being vetted and approved by government curricular reviewers, and they, of course, have limited time and resources to do this. On the other hand, these are a major expense. And there's certainly an awareness in government of this expense and a desire to reduce this. And I've seen a number of curricular material initiatives where the production of the material is paid for by government, and then the material is made available without charge to schools. The Media Awareness Network that I cited earlier is one example of this. And I think we'll see a lot more of this in the future simply because of the cost savings. I mean, that is now and is going to be a huge driver.
Yes, I've got the sensation that the financial and moral crisis of these times is a good booster for open education.
Mm-hmm.
Bueno, at least we get a positive outcome.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask also about the kind of content, because there's a lot of focusing on text media. And I'm wondering what is happening with the production of more open educational resources that are multimedia. I'm not an expert on this field, so
yeah.
Are things going on? Is there interesting, business models regarding multimedia content?
Some of the most interesting and these days widely discussed open educational resource initiatives are video resources. Khan Academy is a classic example of that. Another one is the TED videos. With audio and video, there's the iTunes University, which has all kinds of materials like this. The BBC is a massive producer of audio and video resources that are open. I could go on. I mean, YouTube itself has I can't count. I mean, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of free videos. The big issue with multimedia is that it's harder to categorize, harder to sort, harder to index, harder to find. So the really interesting work here is in things like tagging, automated tagging, accelerated.
Okay, we are talking about semantics and open linked data, right?
That's right. And once good speech recognition comes to the fore, these audio and video resources will become much more accessible. What was really important, especially for audio, was the MP3 format. And until that was widely adopted as the format for open access audio materials, it was very difficult to access open access audio materials. You think back to the days of Real Media and the QuickTime Player and everybody, and even now they all have their own audio formats. But MP3 is what made the world go round. There's been similar delays in video. There is the MP4 standard, which looks like it's becoming a video standard like MP3, but it faced competition for many years from Flash or the FLV format, as well as a number of proprietary video formats. And these proprietary formats have delayed open access video again for a long time. And if you go beyond audio and video and you start thinking about multimedia, simulations, things like that, the same sorts of problems exist, right? You need a common format, you need a common carrier in order for open access to take off. Without that, you're flooded with proprietary formats, it becomes difficult to share from one system to another. It becomes difficult for people to write open source applications that produce this content because, the format is proprietary and, everything is fragmented and commercialized.
So
So,
interoperability, I mean, it's the layer.
yeah. So we need to be looking for these open standards and specifications for multimedia, for simulation, for example, for open worlds, virtual worlds. OpenSim is a good example of a project that does the same sort of thing as Second Life, but in an open format with open standards. And Second Life is sort of faltering, but OpenSim remains an interesting and viable project.
I know about OpenSim. One of my friends is the developer of OpenSim,
There you
so it's
go.
a good project, but there's a lack of funding.
Yeah, there is a lack of, there's always a lack of funding for these things. I mean, that's a constant, isn't it? The only response to this lack of funding is volunteerism. And that raises much wider social issues and social concerns because, a strong volunteer community will support open access, but you need the right social and economic conditions to support a strong volunteer community. People need to have enough income to live on, and they need to have enough spare time to pursue these objectives, and then they need a legal framework that allows them to do so without fear of prosecution. And these are three things that have been in place historically in North America and Western Europe, especially, and now are taking a hold in places like Russia and India and South America. But it's been a long time getting to the point where the social and economic conditions allow for volunteer labor to produce, you know, the basic frameworks for open access.
Yes, but I could say something a little bit. I understand your point, but mm-hmm. for instance, in the south of Europe, no?
Mm-hmm.
Portugal, Greece, Spain, Ireland.
Yeah.
That where we are not paid anymore for work because there's no work anymore.
Yeah.
It's getting to another outcome, that it's increasing the time that we have, so we are devoting more time to volunteering. So it's like the two things. It's better to have a nice economic condition or social income that is fair enough.
Yeah.
But there's also the other situation that when the welfare disappears completely, people get a lot of time and devoted to make interesting things also. So it's,
yeah, the argument is that this is not sustainable.
I will tell you in some years. Right now,
yeah.
We don't know where we are going. We are in the edge, you know. So.
Yeah, and I'm seeing certainly a lot of movement toward open educational resources and open learning, and that especially from Spain. Spain is a hotbed of this, but there's also activity in, as you said, the other southern European countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as an aside, you know. There are longer-term economic potentials from these open access projects, you know, just as there is longer-term economic potential from cooperative work generally.
Mm-hmm.
So it may not be the case that this is simply time that is spent on something that will produce no economic results. Developing an expertise in a discipline, whatever it is helpful for the long-term economic prospects of any region or any country. So there may be a payoff from all of this volunteer work. And indeed, personally, I hope there is. You know, I mean, you know, I hope
you
this...
Say, when you talk about economic long-term potential, you're talking about raising the potential of lifelong learners, people that really engage in learning to learn and therefore increase their skills over the time.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. I can cite my own experience where I've worked in a volunteer capacity, as it were, on a lot of things, including open access, and that has turned into a career for me. And it certainly wasn't my intended career, but, you know, my hobbies became my job. Because I developed an expertise in this, you know,
yeah.
And when you develop an expertise, there's a market. So people in places like Spain who develop an expertise in software, who develop an expertise in content development and the rest of it, will find a market. I mean, and it's a question of access to these markets, and it's a question of finding the right business models, but the it's the skills and the capacity that drives the rest.
Okay, one second. Okay, and then I would go to another issue. I got the sensation, I mean, there's a little bit right now in the initiative that I could map and analyze.
Mm-hmm.
There's the reuse paradox. Everybody focuses in putting resources online, but very few initiatives that I could see are understanding, are monitoring their impact. They don't know which are the characteristics of their users. They don't know who is using their resources or contributing. So maybe I just have a restricted view about the panorama. Do you know... I mean, I've got the sensation that the lack of culture of evaluation and impact assessment, understanding the characteristic of your community.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate observation.
Mm-hmm.
I know I don't do much of it, and you know, I'll bet you there's a lot of production of open resources that appeals to a very limited audience. And the author doesn't really know what that audience is. Not that this is necessarily bad. I mean, the reason for it is these studies and this data takes a lot of effort to collect. You know, it takes a lot of time, a lot of resources. And it's not going to be funded the way commercial research would, because there isn't the commercial incentive. I'm not sure that that's a bad thing. You know, I mean, understanding the impact, etc., is really important from a commercial perspective. It's a lot less important from an academic and creativity perspective. You know, people don't discover laws of nature because they'll have an impact. They discover them because they're there. You know, the argument could be made, and it's a good argument, that funders of this research and funders of these publications need to understand the impact in order to justify their funding. And I think that's a good case. There's a case to be made there. There is an emerging domain in the field of education, and probably more broadly, but my own knowledge is in education, of analytics or learning analytics. These right now are focused, I think, more locally and directly at existing educational environments like learning management systems. But I think the longer-term future of learning analytics is to look at the use of these resources on an internet-wide or worldwide basis. That would be my expectation in any case. And, you know, it's the same issue as in the other areas. You know, it's producing reliable data, but at a lower cost. You know, if you have to run a $50,000 study to understand the impact of your $100,000 OER initiative, that's a real problem. But if you can do it for a $25 piece of software and get accurate data, then that's going to much more likely to be done.
Yes.
So I'd be looking for better analytics software. I do know that there are some initiatives out there. I'd be hard-pressed to name them off the top of my head right now, but I do know that they exist.
Okay. And before going to business and sustainability models, I would like to have your opinion if it's desirable to have quality standards or certification frameworks for open educational research. I'm talking MOOCs, and try to develop a solid certification of informal skills.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Do you think it's possible, and do you think it's desirable?
I really have mixed feelings about that. You know, and you know, I'm one of the people who developed the concept of MOOCs.
Yeah, I saw that.
But I would not be able to get certified if there were, you know, standards, because I can't afford it. So there's a certain way in which these standards or certification frameworks favor enterprises that have a lot of money. And they favor commercial development over open development. So I would be looking for other approaches or other methods for quality assessment and quality verification. And I, in particular, be looking at network mechanisms. You know, Amazon has a mechanism for establishing the quality of its buyers and sellers, and it doesn't cost it anything. It just has other buyers and sellers rate the buyers and sellers. And I think that sort of post hoc method, after this, or, you know, you might call it an a posteriori method, it's certainly cheaper and arguably going to be more effective in the long run, because it will allow unfunded, better initiatives to achieve widespread recognition. So, you know, the whole question of standards and certifications permeates education generally. You know, we have standards and certifications for individual learners. You know, these are curriculum guidelines and grades and certificates and degrees. And we have these for businesses as well. And this overhead, and it really is overhead, becomes less and less necessary as we have better information and communication technologies that make direct assessment rather than assessment via a certificate more possible.
Okay. So, I would like to go to sustainability and business models. Of course, I'm talking about, at the beginning, they were just passing me business models, and I told them that we are to learn sustainability models.
Yeah.
Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I do.
So, I would like to have your opinion. There's two things. I understand that right now there are some successful sustainability models, and then there are some promising ones. And those promising ones might become stronger if some bottlenecks are removed. No, like you said before, that sometimes the legal framework puts you in a situation that you could be, you know.
Yeah.
So sometimes sustainability is not like as good as it could be because there are some stuff. So I would like to have a little bit your opinion in good models of sustainability and promising ones.
In general, I distinguish between producer-centered models and community-centered models.
Mm-hmm.
In the producer-centered model, there is a demand, a customer of some sort, typically a government or a foundation, and they put in a request to a producer who might be an author or a publisher. For you know, some work of some sort. The producer produces it and is paid by the financial supporter.
Mm-hmm.
In the community-based model, people organize themselves into sub-communities or clusters, typically, for example, in the form of a cooperative, although there are various models. And they share the work among themselves and produce a resource or set of resources for common value. Generally, when people are talking about business and sustainability models, they're talking about the producer-centered model. And indeed, that's why the question comes up, because you need some way to pay the producer. In the community-based models, people are producing these resources because they achieve some sort of direct benefit from them.
Uh-huh.
It becomes cheaper and more accessible. These resources become cheaper and more accessible. You know, take banking, for example. People would form a co-op bank or a cooperative or a credit union. Or in Quebec and Atlantic Canada, a Caisse Populaire, because it makes banking services more affordable. And they participate in the management of these, and they receive the returns from this. You know, on a cooperative farm, There are examples of cooperative farms where instead of paying a producer to produce vegetables, people share in the management of a farm and each receive a share of the vegetables. So the cooperative models give us a different picture of businesses and sustainability for open educational resources. Now, what makes these cooperative models work is that they leverage other activity.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, the resource that is produced would have been produced anyway in the course of other activities. And what the cooperative is doing is catching the value at that point and circumventing the business and production cycle.
Mm-hmm.
For example, videos of airplanes landing. Right? Now, if a government wants a video of an airplane landing, this is really expensive. Because you have to get an airplane and land it. Right? But airplanes land every day. And if you take, you know, a $200 digital camera and you put it in the cockpit of a plane, you have a video of an airplane landing.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the pilots do this, they can participate in this cooperative venture. And all the, what they need to do is, you know, monitor, record, and participate in some content creation ventures, such as recording, you know, video recording of an airplane landing, that becomes an educational resource. And it creates this cycle where they're feeding into the resources that new pilots would use in order to become pilots. So it's, you know, the model has been called prosumer, where the consumer of the resource is the same as the producer of the resource. It's also sometimes called community sourcing. And again, you know, it's resources produced by a community for a community. Probably the best example of this is the Open Knowledge Initiative, Open OKI, which produces Sakai, which is a learning management system, an open source learning management system, and a number of other initiatives. DSpace is tied to that as well. And basically, it's people at large universities have formed what really amounts to a cooperative where they all contribute to the labor and they all enjoy the product. You know, your typical business and sustainability models are based on how do we raise the money to pay the producer? And you can run through them really easily. You know, there's foundations, there's government grants, there's upselling and value-added selling, there's advertising. All of these are based around raising money to pay producers. And they all have their advantages and disadvantages. But in my mind, the primary disadvantage is that they result in more expensive production models, in that the best sustainability model is to reduce the cost of production to as close to zero as possible. And that's why these community models and prosumer models are the sort of sustainability approach that I would pursue.
Before going to the two small last questions, I wanted to ask again about the MOOC, because as you were involved in the launching of this concept, I think that it's been like the big buzz, no, the last month. And I saw that there were some private funders, that is quite strange in an initiative like this. So I guess that the Simon potentially coming from it. Do you think it's going to expand because of the need of universities in the 20 years that comes and to go online, or I don't know? I don't know what to think about MOOCs.
It's going to expand, but not necessarily in ways people expect it to. It's interesting. It's interesting, the business models, and like Coursera, and there's another one, the name of which escapes me off the top of my head. I keep thinking Natera, but that's not it. I've looked at them, and basically what they're doing is they're selling access to these courses, so they're no longer open online courses.
How do they sell access? I don't understand.
They charge people to join them.
But that is not an open education initiative.
That's right. And it just takes us full circle back to some of the online course initiatives of the late 90s. I mean, there's so I don't, and I don't think that approach will in the long run be successful, because I don't think the markets are large enough. You know, if you're paying money, you want certification. I mean, that's the deal that people expect. They will be satisfied with just the learning, but only at a much, much lower price, if any price at all. And really, there's no need with the internet the way it is today for them to pay a price. I think there's, you know, it's, I think there is going to be support for MOOCs. I think that this support will come to a large degree from institutions who will actually pay for the MOOC. The model here is MITx, for example, or even the Stanford AI course, which was open access. It creates these large communities around the body of learning. And I think that what we will discover, and this hasn't happened yet, but what we will discover is that they will discover that one MOOC works well in multiple institutions.
That one MOOC works well in?
Multiple institutions.
Yes.
Right? So, because right now, you know, you have the MIT MOOC, you have the Stanford MOOC, whatever, right? But there's no reason why MIT and Stanford can't share the same MOOC. Why not? And now you have this large community, and some of them are MIT students, and some of them are Stanford students. And you begin to realize all kinds of synergies from that. For one thing, there will be an even more creative community than there were previously, because now they have more clearly defined audiences. As well, there's the cross-pollinization of the ideas and thinking from the different institutions. As well, there's the savings and resources. And yet, each institution can define its own unique value add to the MOOC. So, I don't know what that would be. MIT might be, you know, Media Lab, Neat Toys, whatever. Stanford might be ties to the business community. Harvard might be super difficult tests. I don't know, right? Every institute will need to define its own specific advantage. So they'll discover this eventually. They haven't discovered this yet. We did. George Siemens and myself, when we ran our connectivism MOOC, and we discovered that other institutions were interested in having people participate in the MOOC, but they would manage their own testing and marking. And George and I said, sure, fine, no problem. So, and that's what I'm quite sure that's what's going to happen. It'll happen first in the introductory courses, like Intro Logic, Intro Algebra, whatever, where you have this large community, this set of activities that people can do, a serialized set of activities. What I mean by that is you can join at any time and go through the activities at your own pace. When you have large enough communities, you can do these sorts of things. So it will very, you know, it opens up courses, not simply in the sense of making them free, but it opens up courses in the sense of making them more learner-driven, making them more learner-designed. So people access and use these courses in their own way. And so you have people coming from a variety of institutions with a variety of motivations, doing their thing in these environments, and then taking back to their own institutions the value that they got from it.
Okay, thank you, Stephen. And now I will make you a last question. If you want to resume me your main, you can go on to three as you want, recommendations to policymakers that are dealing with education and culture.
What would my, yeah, recommendations to policymakers?
They need a lot of recommendations, you know.
Yeah. I think there need to be appropriate intellectual property regulations to support and enable open access.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a bit difficult to describe in a short answer. Mm-hmm. I would certainly refer them to people like Michael Geist, G-E-I-S-T, in Canada, for a comprehensive statement of the sort of framework that is needed. But you need things like network neutrality. You need things like strong fair use provisions. You need things like protections, consumer protections for open access and open sharing, so that if a person does produce something and share it, that is not simply swallowed up by a company.
Mm-hmm.
You need open markets and open marketplaces, so you need strong anti-monopoly provisions. So that'd be the first thing.
Okay.
The second thing would be that, you know, I would certainly recommend judicious funding of open access initiatives. And that happens to a large degree anyways, and a great deal of stuff is funded by the government. I would say fund broadly rather than deeply.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather see more people get smaller amounts of money, than large, you know, single focused projects of tens of millions of dollars.
Yes, totally. Totally.
And the reason for that is it promotes more diversity. It promotes much greater integration of open access into the wider community. And the smaller initiatives, you know, they allow for more possibility of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And we need the capacity to fail. Because
mm-hmm.
not everything is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you have a large open access program that fails, you know, that can really damage the prospects for future programs.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and Terry Anderson and Walter Archer have written about that. You know, fail small, fail quickly, fail easily.
Mm-hmm.
And then move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So that would probably be the second recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
What would be the third? Government should use open access and instantiate open access policies in their own domain.
Mm-hmm.
Where possible, they should make their own data open access. And, you know, it's interesting, there's been a recent debate in Canada between the Treasury Board, which runs Canada's finances, and the Canadian Post Office over postal codes. And there's a database of postal codes where every postal code is defined geographically. And Canada Post sells this information for a lot of money. And, of course, it has widespread value. And the Treasury Board is saying, you know, this information, this public information, was created by the taxpayer. It should be distributed as open access.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this sort of decision that government faces every day. And when it faces this sort of decision, it should fall on the side of open access.
And what happened in the end?
We don't know yet. It's still open. Yeah. It's still a dispute. it's.
But if it doesn't go to the public sphere, it will be a new domain like OpenStreetMap. It will be Open Postal Code.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. This is the funny thing, right? You can't copyright data And people have recreated the Canadian postal code list. And the post office is suing them.
Yes.
But they created the data themselves.
Yes.
So it's almost exactly like OpenStreetMap, except that the owners of a proprietary street map are suing them. So, yeah, and that's currently, it's a current issue right now, so it hasn't been resolved yet.
Okay, so we'll have a look to what happened in the future.
Yeah.
Stephen, I wanted to thank you for a very interesting interview.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I will write to you to ask you a short biography of 15, 20 lines to be included in the report.
Okay.
And maybe you can send me the email with the contact with the open publisher so I can send in the survey.
I've already done that.
Okay, thank you. And I will come back to you, I guess, around end of September, October, so you can have the report, of course.
All right.
And I don't know if you travel sometimes, but if one day you come to Barcelona, just write to me and it will be very nice to meet you face to face, okay?
Okay.
Take care and keep going with a good job.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.